Okay. So, yeah, so I grew up in a Ghanaian household in an African church. And though, as you know, the majority of Africans are pro-life, it seems to me that we're very generally very apathetic to the abortion issue outside of our own home. So I'm just curious. We Africans are not really involved in the pro-life outreach. How did you become passionate about the pro-life issue?
Yeah, so I would say, like, I was, like most other Africans, I was raised in a pro-life society. I'd say I was born and raised in Nigeria. In fact, I lived in Nigeria until I was in my mid-20s. So, I lived up to adulthood in my own country. So, I came from a pro-life society. But, again, yes, as you point out, we didn't have a lot of pro-life activities going on, and I came to the UK to study and to pursue, the advancement of my career. I work as a scientist, so I kind of wanted to be in a place where I'd have opportunity to study further and do a bit more with my career. And I one day stumbled upon a project that was being carried out by the wife of Bill Gates, Melinda Gates, that's her name, so this 2012, and she was doing this massive program on contraception. She was listing or talking about the countries that she was going to, where her project was targeted at, and the way she talked about it, it wasn't very difficult even at the time to see target in African countries. She said she was going to do the program in the 69 poorest countries in the world, and there are 54 African countries. Once you check it, you see that most of the 54 African countries actually fall in that category. So she was coming for African people, and I felt this was not right. And the way she talked about the project and the way she talked about her initiative, I felt this was a whole new population control movement that she was doing, starting off. So I wrote an open letter that then went viral. It then became known as the open letter to Melinda Gates. And it was this letter, how things happen now that we have the internet. Once something goes viral, a number of things could happen. There's a lot of attention, unwanted attention.
Yep.
To yourself. I didn't mean for any of that to happen, but actually millions of people got to read this letter in different places, and there were so many reactions. Some were positive and some were negative. So this was really what forced me. So in a way, I was kind of compelled into this position. I was defending the African view, because I was really coming from an African view and saying, as an African woman, I just think that there are better ways to spend millions of dollars in humanitarian aid if you wanted to help us. So this then kind of led to other discussions. I started engaging online. This was back in 2012. Blogs were very popular at the time. I was going on different people's blogs, guest blogging, debating people online, and gradually one thing led to another, and it just became this pro-life career, right, on the side of my own professional work, because I didn't train to be a pro-life advocate or pro-life activist, really. So this is how an African itself, who was raised in a society where it's not very common for people to go out and speak, quite openly. Pro-life issues, even though people are overwhelmingly pro-life anyway. This is how I then got into this position where I get to spend a lot of my time now speaking about pro-life issues, especially from the African perspective.
Wow, fantastic. Wow. Okay, so you've already kind of touched on it, but you've described the West and Africa's relationship to abortion as neocolonialism. So to those who may not understand why you would phrase it that way, can you describe why you do so?
Yeah, so neocolonialism was a word that I didn't come up with. Other people have spoken about it, in fact, for a long time, even as far back as your own Kwame Nkrumah wrote a book that's actually entitled Neocolonialism, but yeah. at the time he was talking about an economic neocolonialism that Africans had come out of a colonial situation, but then they were still in many ways connected to Western countries through various economic channels, and he was lamenting that in his excellent essay that he wrote that then became known as this book. So my own point of speaking about this is really in a way just trying to tell people that African nations are still linked to Western countries, and not just Western countries, they are linked to Western entities, be it Western organizations, be it Western foundations, private foundations like the Gates Foundation, and many other foundations for that matter. But a lot of Western entities have become what I'll call stakeholders in across the African continent, and they are so deeply rooted in our system beyond anything that most people would see ordinarily. They are giving African countries aid, they are giving help. A lot of them are doing some good work, I must say that outright. But within those relationships between African countries and these Western entities, there is something that is now becoming more obvious, more prominent. It's coming through these relationships, but it's all about ideology. It's all about a transfer of ideology and a transfer of ideals and ideas through channels that were founded for humanitarian aid. So yes, they're bringing in food, they're bringing in water, healthcare, and all those kinds of things. But then within those relationships are then policies that would then entail, or that would mean that African countries will have to, in many ways, adopt what might just be a new ideology when looking at it from the African perspective. So I can give an example. Most of the African countries do not have legal abortion, and most of them don't want legal abortion. They're not asking, trying to legalize abortion. But then a lot of Western countries who are also donor nations, who are stakeholders in various African countries, have legal abortion. Not just that they have legal abortion, they promote legal abortion. They are they've become very pro-abortion in their own policy stance. And it's filtering into their foreign policy. So this is affecting African countries, whether we like it or not. They are making it a part of hassle of their work, of their humanitarian work in various African countries and various African communities. So this then becomes the point of neocolonialism. Humanitarian aid then becomes a gateway to neocolonialism, because these are values and ideals and ideas that ordinarily an African will not on its own go for. They be most times people don't want these things. Most times people are in fact staunchly against it, but then and the donor brings it. The donor brings it with millions of dollars of other things, right? So it's either you're going to reject the donor's money and donor's gifts, as well as the ideologies, or you accept all those gifts and then in some way try to appease them or try to adopt what they're giving. This is colonialism. This is not a geopolitical colonialism, but it's a cultural and ideological colonialism. We cannot deny, which is real, which the African countries are very much involved or engaged in right now, as a result of our economic dependence on donors.
Wow. So in light of that, then, what are the African leaders? How are they reacting to this? And in light of that too, how do we get Africans in the motherland or across the diaspora more engaged in this pro-life outreach?
Right. So there are two questions there, and I'll take them one after the other. What about the African leaders? What are they doing concerning this? The African leaders, I am very ashamed to say, most of them have submitted or subordinated themselves to the donors' will and to the donor's way. So even though they know that the people are against it, the people, you know, the people of a particular nation, they don't care for abortion, no one is going screaming for their abortion rights and all whatnot. But then they sit down with donors who they know where their values lie, right? So I see them at the United Nations. I go to the UN every year, especially during the women's event. And you see African leaders, diplomats, and African nations sitting together and co-sponsor, you know, kind of co-hosting events. At the UN with donors, with donor nations, on issues that are, you know, kind of putting issues from a Western perspective. So let me just give you an example of this, right? So you find a nation like Congo or Cameroon, like a Francophone African country, and they're co-hosting an event at the United Nations with France, right? So which is not really surprising. Their history together. France was the colonial nation that France was the nation that actually colonized Cameroon and also colonized Congo. So these Francophone African countries usually do a lot of things together at the UN or other international forums with a country like France. France's legal abortion. France, in many ways, has free abortions as well. They're paying for abortions and all whatnot. Now they choose a topic or a subject matter like teenage pregnancies in Africa, and you find that everything that they speak about at these events will really be from a point of view of France, not African nations. So the problem or the subject matter then becomes African children, African teenage girls, but then the solution being preferred all the time, and the speakers on such panels or the speakers on such events will be from the pro-abortion point of view, from the point of view of the master. So we're still in that position where they're talking about our problems, but then they are talking about our problems like we are children, a lot of paternalism, and our leaders constantly accept that as status quo. They are also, another thing is that our leaders have access to donors. Let our leaders give such access to donors that shouldn't be. So, for example, any wealthy donor can come into an African Ministry of Health, Ministry of Education. You know, they are they're partnering, quote unquote, partnering with us all the time, do things in various African countries. But then, in so doing, they are getting almost unfettered access to African, some of the most important aspects of the African nation's governance. So our various ministries, things, you know, about government, that if you went to a Western nation, the equivalent of it is usually very well guarded. You know, where here we talk about privacy and information and all of those things, all things that people hold there and governments hold there in Western nations is not the same for same standard for African countries. So African countries are constantly in this position where it's almost like an open door policy they're dealing with a donor, as long as they are dealing with a donor nation or a donor organization. It's an open door policy, and our African leaders have put us in that position, right? So this is where it is. But I'll just say this as an exception. There are some leaders and some of the African governments that are doing it. The president of Ghana, for example, Nana Akufo-Addo, has been particularly good in pointing out and calling out Western donors about the whole donor system and how the thing works. He has criticized the system. I don't know what exactly then is happening based off of that, because the last I checked, Ghana is still a huge recipient of funding from the various DAC countries. DAC stands for the Development Assistance Committee countries. So these are really donor nations, the little organization that they formed. So Ghana is still a recipient, like most other African countries. But then the leadership that Ghana has shown since President Nana Akufo-Addo has been in power has been quite encouraging. It's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, there's been several instances where where he made fantastic speeches that touch on aid, which is hardly ever the case with other African leaders. Mm-hmm. There's also the president of Tanzania, who at least of recent has spoken up on something like population control among his own people, and he has made some moves, right, towards checking what is going on between his country and the donors. So these are just a few exceptions, but it's been very bad with our leaders, and they put us in this vulnerable position. I just take it that, you know how I initially talked about being the gateway to neocolonialism? Mm-hmm. Well, the gatekeepers are the African leaders, mm-hmm. and they leave the door open all the time. Wow. We're always leaving an open door for donors to walk in, and they're thinking probably this is the way our country will get money, or this is the way we get some attract some funding. But it's actually not logical, because in any situation, if you leave your house door open, you are bound to get abused. You are bound to get people who will use that as against you, and who will actually that actually puts you in a weakened position. So that's mm-hmm. where the African leaders are. Mm-hmm. Then you asked about what the regular Africans would do to engage more in like pro-life issues, right? Mm-hmm. So how people must get to know what's going on. I find that one of the most unfortunate things with regards to our African people, our beloved African people, is the lack of information. We have a huge gap there whereby most Africans, wherever we find ourselves, we are dependent on the Western media to give us information, including information about our own continent. The average Ghanaian knows absolutely nothing about any other African country except Ghana. Right?
So the
average Nigerian cannot tell you who is in, what is going on in Mali. I mean, we don't even think about our other African brothers and sisters and what is going on in the various nations. So all the information we have is coming through this one channel, which is mostly the Western media. Even today, I find, it wasn't so much the case many years ago, but these days it's really become the case as well, that across the various African countries too, they are depending on the West to give them information about Africa, which is on. In Nigeria, for example, the most common news channel is CNN.
Yeah.
And I find it quite appalling that you walk into a bank in Lagos, and CNN is playing all through the 10 hours that the bank is open. It's unbelievable. But this is the way information is filtering through to us. And of course, Western media, goes without saying, Western media will not touch anything that, like neocolonialism, or to expose anything like that. So if we are lacking information, then what has to happen is that our people must somehow get the information. We have to find a way to get through to our brothers and sisters in various countries, people in diaspora. Because I find that once I explain to people what is going on, there is outrage. And right, so if there is outrage, then naturally there should then be action, right? Mm-hmm. We should have our African brothers and sisters in diaspora, and even those at home, getting the right information and also allowing themselves to be outraged. And no longer be comfortable with the status quo. I find that many people, like many of my friends or many fellow Nigerians who are abroad, I meet them in the UK, I meet them in the US or Canada, they're usually fairly comfortable because, they've left the process of poverty maybe, and, they're in a place where they're happy, they have like good jobs, they feel everything is working, they are in a place where everything quote-unquote works. which in many ways is true, but then they close their eyes to the injustice, something like the injustice of abortion, be it how it's happening, you know, how through neocolonialism it's affecting their own home countries, or how it's also ravaging the society around them if they are in a Western country. So any Nigerian or any Ghanaian or any African person from any country, if you are in a Western nation, just know that you are in a place where unborn babies are being killed, whether we know it or not, whether we're finding out the reality about it or not. But most Africans can close their eyes or stay blessedly ignorant about pro-life issues and the injustices happening around them, that then nothing happens. Then, you know, they kind of remain inactive, dispassionate about it. But I just think information is what should come first, and then outrage, and then the right action will then ensue.
Fantastic. Okay. So I am personally in the middle of my in the middle of fundraising my salary for a new position I've just been hired at the Canadian Center for Bioethical Reform. We are a pro-life group that uses abortion victim photography to expose what abortion really is. So I was just wondering.
Yeah, that's definitely great.
Yeah. Well, so she's actually just moved on to the States, but she was one of the, I think she started it, or one of the people that started
founding.
It.
Oh. Yeah.
Okay, so I didn't know you were...
I know about it, yeah.
Oh, okay. So yeah, I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on abortion victim photography?
Yeah, so now, okay, let me just step back.
Okay.
All right, that I can get a full picture for you here.
Okay.
So when on the issue of abortion, I am one of those people that would like to at all times compare it to slavery. You know, it's actually one of my there are many ways I approach the matter of abortion as the way we are experiencing it in the world today. However, one of the ways I do it is by bringing back to or calling people's attention to what happened during the time of slavery. I have done a lot of I've done a lot of reading and study about it. I'm very, very much interested in what happened at that time, because I think that was also how once I got into the pro-life movement, it didn't take long for me to become very passionate about it, because before ever I joined the pro-life movement, I was always one very interested in slavery and how managed, you know, how did we all then become just equal? You know, how was it ever acceptable, or how did we ever get through this horrible injustice, you know, that happened, that was slavery, and to the point where we are now, where I would say, at least by law, we are, you know, we are seen in the eyes of the law in any country we go to as equal beings, right, with anybody else. So I love to make those comparisons, and even when you do more specific reading and read books and biographies of people like William Wilberforce, to see their day-to-day activities, what happened during that time, you would find that these similarities are uncanny. It's unbelievable. I mean, there are some things that I read, people's diaries, letters that I read. I've done really a lot of reading in this regard. It's so similar. It's more similar than most people understand or will admit. However, coming to what you talked about using photography, now I also know that during the time of slavery there were three ways that the abolitionists worked for the ending of this injustice. Something so massive like slavery needed many tactics for a real end to come to it, and one of it was the use of photography. Right, it wasn't the only thing. It was the way to reach certain people. It wasn't the way to reach everyone. But then there was an audience that needed the photography for a change of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was an important part of bringing that injustice to an end. Now, coming abortion and the injustice of abortion, the abortion regime that we find ourselves in now that almost seems insurmountable, for that in most countries across the Western world, this is a legal thing. It's in most countries across the Western world, it's even free, it's facilitated. Government, there's all kinds of things. It's become a beast on its own. It's become huge, as big as slavery. It's not bigger in many ways, because now these countries are all that more powerful than they were in the past. So yes, I believe that something as massive as abortion needs many women and particular people that you can only reach by offering them help, by offering assistance. And that's where the crisis pregnancy people come in. There are many people that you can reach by intellectual discourse, and there are many who are also engaged in that sort of conversation. There are some people that you would reach as well by showing them photography, and I believe in that. I come from a science background. So I believe that there is need for two kinds of photography. The kind where you show people an unborn child and the development of a child. And anyone who looks at my Twitter would see that I use a lot of that. So it's like ultrasound, because all these things are there now and we have access to them. And this is the age of So I believe in using those images, but also if you're going to show all of that, the baby and the developed baby and all that, yes, there are some people, even though yes, you do it with caution, knowing that also there are all that so if you are dealing with a mixed audience and you don't know who is in the crowd and what could come off of it, but yet there are still people that you need to show.
Mm-hmm.
If this is what a developed baby looks like, this is what it looks like when you kill them. Because there have been cases too where people have picked up babies' body parts and things like that. This is what abortion does, and I think there is room and there is need in some cases to share those images.
Absolutely, oh, fantastic. Okay, so now this is the most important question of the entire interview. So if you're truly pro-life, this should be very easy for you. So if you're truly pro-life, okay, you'll agree that Ghanaian jollof is better than Nigerian jollof, right?
No!
It's a very simple question.
No!
If you're truly pro-life, this is a very easy question for you, right? Because you would agree that there's nothing more pro-death than Nigerian jollof, right?
Our jollof rice is the best, but you know that, right? You know that. Nigerian jollof rice has no part two, as they say.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I figured you'd say that, but I had to see if you were truly pro life or not. So the question is, you're not that pro life. That's okay. Oh, I'm just kidding.
No, really, Nigerian jollof rice is the best.
Okay. If you don't mind, one more question. If you don't mind. This one you can answer it briefly. I know it's late over there, but so I'm a Protestant. I'm a Baptist, and you're a Catholic.
Yes.
And one of the things that's very obvious to me is there is a serious lack of Protestants in the pro-life movement. You Catholics have done an incredible job of despite our differences. One thing that's very clear to me is you guys, when it comes to
the
pro-life movement,
the unity.
Well, that too. But I mean, when it comes to pro-life movement, you guys are easily the leaders, right? And I'm curious as to why do you think that is? Why do you think that Catholics are much more active in the pro-life movement than the Protestants are?
Well, at the moment, what is that? Let me link it to. I think John Paul II had a lot to do with it during the pontificate of John Paul II. So this was from 1989. Mind you, abortion actually only became legal like 10 years prior to that. Like in Canada, it became legal in 69. In the UK, 67. So by 1979, when John Paul II became Pope, I'll say abortion was a fairly new phenomenon, you know, 10 years post, right? And many countries, in fact, didn't legalize abortion until later. I think in France it was 75. So, like the very beginning of this entire whole crisis that has now lasted even up to now. And I think John Paul II, if you look back, his pontificate was one that, from the very beginning, he called out to just ordinary people, you know, lay people, to get involved in this particular type of ministry. And I think he set the tone for it. And since then, he did a major foundational work to call out to Catholics all over the world. And for Catholics, the one thing you know is that Rome means everything. Catholics, like marching orders, right? So it's like something like that. If a Pope stands behind a particular movement, you know that, you know, easily a billion people are already there. You know, many bishops, they're then calling on to their dioceses or the people, their own flock, and it filters really down to the churches. It's a little bit different, the apostle churches and the evangelical churches, because there isn't that one central leadership. Mm-hmm. So now, but even though, having said that, I would say someone like Graham easily could have sort of been seen as a kind of a central figure or a uniting figure within the evangelical movement or in the Protestant movement. If he, for example, at the same time or in the same era, were in his most active years, if he had called out, okay, in a similar manner, right, for people to, even though, yes, he was pro-life, that's very clear. He was a fantastic man of God and he was pro-life, but there was not really any huge out to the pro-life in any official sense, right? So if he did a lot of crusades, he spoke to, I don't know how many millions of people by the end of his life. When they were talking about how many millions of people he addressed, imagine if even one of his crusades was on the theme of the abortion. That may have changed the tone for the Protestant churches. And today we don't have any similar.
Yeah.
So we have his son right now is amazing.
Yeah.
I think it's Franklin Graham. He is so good.
Yeah.
But then, unfortunately, he has nowhere as clout as his father, right?
Yes.
So he only is. He still has access to a lot of people, but then he's standing shoulder to shoulder with like many other evangelical leaders. So, and then there's all these people who are like in black churches, and so there's all these smaller leaders who can only do so much. But I think we missed that opportunity where at the right time, the person who was there at the right time, at the very beginning of the abortion movement and the abortion crisis, was the Pastor Graham. If he had at the time taken the opportunity to call out, it would have filtered through to many countries around the world, because he was seen as a central figure.
That's actually an amazing.
So I think that's the only thing.
That's an amazing point that I didn't consider, because even back in Ghana, when I didn't know much about really anything, I knew who Billy Graham was, because his crusades or his sermons were internationally broadcasted.
Everywhere.
Yeah, so you're right. If he had even just had one, you know, talk about it, as you said, he's pro-life, but if he had actually made that a more central part of his message, that would have been extremely influential. So, wow, that's a good point.
Yeah, now his son does a lot. I mean, like on his Facebook, he's always talking about like the laws, the policies. If his father had even done half of what he's doing now, it could have been a completely different matter. He could have set the tone. He could have shown the people that it can really be put together with the practice of faith. You know, so it's almost like the Protestants never really learned how to put it, incorporate it into their practice of faith. So as Billy Graham taught people, and you know, Billy Graham kind of is the father of a lot of the new evangelicals now, but he didn't teach them how to incorporate this. But we're taught by John Paul II, and John Paul II, you know, it filtered down, that it doesn't even matter now if we were Pope, you know, or if we get to a day where we have a Pope who doesn't talk about abortion. The system has already been set. We have a foundation. You know, John Paul II wrote a lot of letters and a lot of things. He wrote a whole document about abortion. So we hold on to that, and that stays forever. But I think there was a missed opportunity within the Protestant movement that could have been amazing. But now I know a lot of amazing Protestant bishops and pastors and people in ministry who are pro-life. But then the problem is they are only speaking to a smaller congregation. You know, even if it's a few, couple of thousand people, it's still not enough to get to everybody in different countries, because now people are setting their own tone and the tone of their ministry. So,
okay.
So that's it.
Okay. Well, honestly, thank you so much. This has been I've interviewed, you know, a number of people, and I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy this. This is fantastic. You've given me incredible wisdom and information, and I really, really thank you for committing your time. I know it's very late there. I know it's probably, 9 o'clock over there, almost 10.
Fine.
Yeah, I really thank you so much.
No, it's 9:45. But it's okay. No, I wanted to say, tell me your job now. You have to fundraise for how long? Like, are you fundraising for your salary for a year or indefinite, or what is your?
Yeah,
is the arrangement?
Yeah, so right now as you know, because of the nature of the Canadian government, we don't receive any kind of funding from them. Because otherwise we have no real control over what we can do. So because of that, we rely 100% on donors. So for me, it's on every single person. So for me, my job is to raise my salary altogether. So it's not just for a year; it's for ongoing. So people some people donate to me, you know, give me one time donations. But what I'm mostly looking for is monthly donations, and So then hopefully it's indefinite. Now, of course, whenever they want, they can choose to suspend that or to discontinue that. Ideally, what I'm looking for is monthly donors and things like that. But as
monthly,
I said,
so that it can sustain. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So do you have any page or anything? Do you have like a GoFundMe page? What do you have set up?
Oh wow. That's one thing TCBR is working on. So me personally, the way it is, people who donate to me, they don't give it to me directly. They put it in under my name, but really to CCBR. We have a website where people can donate one-time offers on my behalf on the website. But then when it comes to the monthly donors, what people do is I have a PDF donation copy where I send it to them, and then they either write in their information and mail it to me or to CCBR, or they just kind of scan it and then they send it to me. But they're working on an online version where people can actually donate monthly. But for now, it's either one-time donations on a website or sending me, you know, the donor information directly or to CCBR.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So what you can do when you have it, once they've set up like a page, like a link or something where people can go and read about, and then decide, right? Please let me have it so that I can share that. All right.
Oh wow! Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, that's it. Go ahead.
So if you don't mind, so on my blog, I've written an article dedicated to my role at CCBR and what I'll be doing there, and on that website, I give people information as to how they can either donate online one time or how they can become monthly donors, and that's on my blog. And so if you want, I mean, not to put pressure on you.
To write, I'm joining the staff. I'm looking at it now. Canadian Center. Yeah. Okay, that's fine. So I'm going to have this page out, and I'll share the link on Twitter.
You are like so kind. Wow, thank you so much.
No,
wow, no, really, you have
no, 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 it's, uh, 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 but I'm really impressed with what you're doing, and I think it's well worth it. It's just, I didn't know like where you were. I knew you were with an organization, but I didn't know. I wanted to understand more. And I just felt it, hearing it from you. So that's fine.
No, I'll be honest. I'm surprised I'm even able to be coherent in this interview, because you're a huge hero to me. You know, even though you're Nigerian, I forgive you for that. But but really though, like honestly,
who has come to Ghana?
No, that's true.
Hey,
no,
I proposed the first ever March for Life that was organized by the Catholic Bishops Conference in Ghana.
Wow!
I went to Ghana to fight the bishops for it.
Wow.
In 2014, in 2015, they did the first time ever March for Life through Accra.
Wow.
Which was incredible, and it was covered by press and everything.
Oh, that's so amazing.
I've done it not for your country. So
I'm bugging you, but really though, you're a hero to me. You know, I was very much one of those guys who didn't really care too much about, you know, I mean, I knew it was wrong, but I wasn't too concerned about it. But it was through just through you and reading and just seeing your passion, I'm like, you know, I want to try and do as much as that for my, you know, for my country, you know, Canada. And of course Ghana's my country too, but, and I would love to, you know, if I can go back there one day and help out with what's happening there in Ghana, because I know that abortion has jumped up. Like it's become really, I think just 2 years ago I read that I think it was 4 years ago they had 10,000 abortions in Ghana, but then 2 years later it became 50,000, you know. And that's
I'll tell you what, let me tell you something. There is have you ever heard of Gutmacherinse? There are all these Western organizations that go out to Africa and they chunk out these figures. So don't believe everything here, even though yes, abortion is actually, you know, it's fairly common in a country like Ghana and Nigeria. In countries like Ghana and Nigeria. It's fairly common. Okay. But the problem is the complications with abortion and who's doing it. It's not Bakale. A lot of times it's being done by Western organizations. A Western organization like Marie Stopes International, they're actually quite big in Ghana. They're doing a lot of these illegal abortions, and they should be a crackdown on them. And that's, you know, that's what we're fighting, you know, to kind of truncate what they are doing, and they get Western funding and coming in and aborting African kids. For Marie Stopes, it wasn't as bad, but then who's doing it? It's not, you know, it's not some quack doctor in some back alley, right? Those are numbers being counted. The numbers being counted are coming from these Western NGOs going around marketing abortion to kids. First, they market the condoms to kids, you know, on the streets of African countries, and then they are the, you know, the sex experts who then, you know, who then attack them to their clinics and all whatnot.
There's
a lot of work for you to do in Ghana as well.
Yeah, I would love to. I would absolutely love to. So it's funny, actually. I know you did the March for Life in Ottawa, but just this year, actually, we had the first March for Life in Toronto, and I was very, very humbled to be one of the speakers there, actually, just last week.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, and it's shocking to me that it was actually the first one in Toronto, the biggest city in Canada, but I'm glad that it happened, and I was glad I was able to be there. And honestly, it's really in large thanks to you, really. So thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Oh,
and
thank you.
I'm shocked that I was able to, you know, be able to speak to you, because you're a huge hero to me, and I thank you so much. And you're here to many, many people. I know you already know that, but I still want to let you know.
But seriously, I am grateful. You know, it's things get out of hand, and I seem to be working all the time because I have I have my job as well, and still working as a scientist and still trying to do my life work. So that's just the point. Then it seems as if I'm so scarce. It's not. But seriously, I'm very grateful for your work, and I'm hoping that we can see you do more. You know, we can see you do more, because it's just wonderful to see young black people, especially young black men, coming out and being prominent within the polite movement, because that's there is a crisis. There's a crisis among Black people,
yeah.
And that's a crisis of fatherlessness,
yeah.
Within the Black communities, whichever country it is,
yeah.
As the Western countries. So it's great to see you doing what you're doing in Canada, but I also need to let you know that you have to go to Africa at some point.
Absolutely.
When I'm doing something in Africa, maybe I'll tell you.
I would be happy to do so.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Okay, God bless, and best of luck in your work and your new career and the career that you've chosen. I pray that everything will go well and God will use you greatly and to do amazing things within the pro-life movement. Okay.
Thank you so much.
So, well done. Well done, and stay in touch.
Oh, I will.
When you're trying to interact. You me just stay in touch.
Okay. Absolutely, I will. Thank you so much.
All right, you take
care. All right, okay, bye.
All right, bye.